Okay, good morning, Professor Bolthausen. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of this interview, we're going to be mainly going over ideas surrounding spinning glasses and replica symmetry breaking, which we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995, but with a bit of leeway in these dates. And before we dive into this, and to help us a bit situate your own contributions, can you tell us what first interested you in mathematics and what led you to pursue graduate studies in probability and statistics?
Yeah, I originally, when I actually really originally I wanted to study physics, but at ETH, so but then at ETH actually physics and mathematics for the first year is completely parallel, and so I switched to mathematics. But I still had a lot of, at that time when you studied mathematics at ETH in Zurich, so there was a lot of physics. One had to take a lot of physics courses. So I took quite a number of physics courses during my math study. And originally I was more interested in abstract mathematics, so algebra, and so that was my focus, also on logic. And it depends also on the teacher you have. So I was my main teacher at ETH in mathematics was Benno Eggman. So that's the father of Jean-Pierre Eggman. So I also made my thesis with him, on relatively abstract algebra. But then I wanted to switch to something more applied, and I got the postdoc position where I could do. Originally, I wanted to do something really applied statistics, but then I was hooked more with probability theory. That was my starting point in probability theory. That was a postdoc position at the university in Constance.
But so just to, before we move along, so what, where did your interest in physics come from? Why did you first wanted to do physics then?
Yeah, that dates back actually during high school. It's difficult to say. Originally, I wanted to study in high school. I wanted to study chemistry. And then actually, this high school had a fantastic lab. And actually, we had a very good chemistry teacher. And we could in the 3 days to go into the lab and just make experiments ourselves. I think totally today it would be totally forbidden to do that in this way we were doing it. But then I realized that I'm not so good in experiments. And then I became more interested to go to physics. And we also had an excellent physics teacher.
So mainly through school then, your exposure through school. So to try to make a very crude picture, but from what I could tell, is that over the first couple of decades of your career, you seem to have moved to an ever greater engagement with problems in mathematical physics. What drew you in that direction in general?
Yeah, originally okay. I was working more on classical limit theorems and had some papers in more classical stuff. And then I became interested in large deviation theory, but probably just because that was at the time when Donsker and Varadam were publishing their paper on large deviations. I just studied them and got hooked to large deviations. Now, obviously, large deviation is very much connected with physics, with mathematical physics, or of course, in particular, with mean field models, mean field type models. Occasionally, rather complicated mean field type models like the I was totally hooked with this Polaron problem. I don't know if you're. Mm-hmm. If you are familiar with that, Donsker Varadam had a fantastic paper applying large deviation theory to this Polaron problem. So I got interested in these kind of things more and more. And also their paper on this, what is called the Wiener sausage, which is also connected, strongly connected with topics in mathematical physics. So I got then more and more driven in this direction, I have to say. It was just coming, okay. It was not dependent on this particular teacher I had in Konstanz. Konstanz is not very far from Zurich. We also regularly went to Zurich, so to seminars. So the activities in Zurich were more intensive than in Konstanz. And so it's just one hour drive to Zurich. At that time, Hans Vollmer was in Zurich, and we went to his seminars, and he was also interested in statistical physics at that time. So it developed in this way. And a bit later, I got interested also in random media. So for instance, I had written a paper that was quite later. I had written a paper on this directed polymers in random environments. I was just driving in this direction, and it was totally natural that I became interested in spin classes and the Schrödinger-Patrick model. That was unavoidable. came into contact with that. So
when did you actually first hear about spin classes, and sort of what drew you to that problem at that point?
Yeah. That is difficult to say. So I don't know exactly. After Konstanz, I had for a short time a position in Frankfurt. And actually, in Frankfurt, I had also close contacts with Hermann Rost, who was also very much interested in mathematical physics. And afterwards, I had a position in Berlin. And in Berlin, I had close contact with some people really from theoretical physics, mathematical physics. So like Robert Schrader, for instance, I don't know. He's very well known in theoretical physics. He died a couple of years ago. But in Berlin, he also gave me papers. He was more knowledgeable about this background, and he showed me results by Imbri, John Imbri and Tom Spencer about directed polymers, and then I was able to make a contribution to that after looking at that. I don't really know where I first came into contact with spin classes, but it was totally natural because I was interested in mean field models from my interest in large deviations, and I became more and more interested in random media, also random walks in random media. Somehow evident that I should fall at one day on Sheridan Kirkpatrick and look at that. But I cannot exactly fix the date. When I first came into contact with that.
So Michael Eisenman mentioned that he might have steered you in this direction. Do you recollect that discussion or that interaction?
That could well be. So Michael Eisenman. Michael Eisenman, but that was after Berlin. I was in Zurich, so then I came to Zurich in the end of 80s, and then I met Michael Eisenman several times. It could well be that it was he who brought me to that, but I think I saw his paper. This was one of the earliest. Papers on earliest rigorous on rigorous results in spin class theory. That was this Eisenman-Lipovitz-Riel. So that I studied carefully. But I'm not sure that Michael showed me that or that I came across that before. But you see, in Zurich, when I was in Zurich, also Alain Snitman was interested in it. And I had very close contact with Alain Snitman. We got interested in spin class theory. But it was particularly attractive for me as there was not much theory, mathematical theory around at that time. So that's that is related with the fact that I'm typically I'm not so good with studying complicated theory of topics which which there is a huge amount of existing literature, and you first have to read that before you can do anything. And but probably I had the impression maybe one can do something because they're without spending 2 years of learning theory before, so that might have been a motivation also. But then I was very much interested in the paper by Asimov, Lipovitz, Riehl, and there was a parallel paper by Friedrich Segalinski at that time with somehow similar flavor, so a little bit going to a little bit another direction. So that was it.
I see. So Michel Talleyrand told us that he actually first heard about spin glasses from you at a meeting in 1993.
And yes.
Why did you think that the problem would be appropriate or interesting to him? Or was it a topic that you were discussing with many other people at that time?
No. I listened to the interview with Michel. And what he said about that. Michel probably was not aware. So I had a very good reason for asking him about it. So that was, of course, he was already very well known for the theories about general Gaussian processes. One of the key results he had was actually he solved a relatively well-known problem, this dominating measure, so the necessity of the dominating measure criterion for Gaussian processes. So now that was originally going back to Fernic. So Fernic gave a criteria of, it was on several issues on Gaussian processes, continuity, a criterion for continuity, but also characterization of the maximum in terms of an entropy condition. So that it had a longer history, so the whole topic, but Fernic gave this criterion which was then called dominating measure criterion. So it was proved by Fernic to be sufficient, for instance, to prove that certain Gaussian processes are bounded, and then it was a difficult thing to prove that it was actually also necessary. I think many people thought it was not true. But finally, Talleyrand proved that it was also necessary, so it was equivalent to certain properties of Gaussian processes, and this proof I had studied carefully by Talleyrand. Now this proof was, of course, it's about the same problems as you are facing in Schering and Kirkpatrick, because it's a criterion for finiteness of the maximums of after some normalization. And then I realized that actually his proof was very much based on ultrametricity. It is very general. But it was really based on a proof that you can approximate things by ultrametricity. And then I looked at it for Sherrington Kirkpatrick, and for Sherrington Kirkpatrick it was useless because you the thing is very general, but you couldn't characterize constants. So for instance, you could give the maximum only up to constants. So you could never prove anything anything like the Parisi formula for the maximum of Sherrington Kirkpatrick. So that was evident after I looked carefully at it. But still, I thought maybe one can do some refinement of his ultrametric approximations, And I tried a little bit myself, of course, without success. And then, but then I thought it was evident that that Telegram would be the right person to ask about that. So that was, and then I met him at this conference in Aarhus, and so I explained to him. He immediately got hooked to it. He contacted me about basic background literature and things like that. That was the way I came to the idea to ask Telegram. So later he told me these were the most influential 20 minutes of his life. So that was.
So in the preface to your book on spin glasses, you mentioned the 1996 workshop in Berlin that brought together the mathematicians interested in spin glasses. First, were you present at that meeting? And if yes, can you tell us a bit more about the importance of that meeting in your mind?
You say in 96 in Berlin?
Yes.
I never organized a workshop on spin glasses in Berlin.
No. You were not an organizer. It was a Bouvier who organized it with Pico.
Oh, no, I wasn't present there. No.
Okay.
No, I wasn't present at this conference. So I had it organized with Bouvier. I had organized one in Ascona. But that was later then. That was considerably later.
So what was your involvement then with the community after having talked to Michel Talleyrand? Did you regularly read the literature and attend meetings about?
I followed and I had written a couple of papers even more recently, so about topics in spin glasses. So I followed it very closely. I was very much interested in it. So he had organized a meeting in that was with Bouvier in Ascona in Monte Verita, and that was exactly at the time when Talleyrand had proved the Parisi formula, had a rigorous proof of the Parisi formula. So we had a meeting. You know Monte Verita?
Yes, I think it's a 2003 meeting, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was a 2003 meeting. We essentially got, not everybody, but many of the important actors in spin glass theory. We were able to get to Ascona. So Talleyrand, Guerra, Parisi, Eisenmann were there, I believe it had some influence on the cooperation between physicists and mathematicians. Because both sides were present there, and it was exactly at the time when there was big progress. The paper by Guerra had already appeared, and Talleyrand had had announced his results, but the paper was not yet available. So that was just at that time. I think it was a somehow influential meeting.
It was timely for sure. Can you describe a bit more about the excitement that was emerging from this? Was there really a communication between the two groups? Was there a common language that could be?
Yeah, I think so. So I think Talleyrand had contact with Paris. He had a lot of discussions with Michael Eisenmann at this meeting. So I knew, you see, Michael didn't. Michael was. Was a little skeptical about the way Talleyrand was attacking this problem, I would say. So actually Michael told me, but also Talleyrand was a little bit annoyed by the skepticism about by Michael Eisenmann. The paper was not yet out, so by Vitala Grazia. So there were a little bit of tensions between the main actors. But I think then they communicated quite closely, and also Michael Eisenman with Guérin Actually, Jürg Fröhlich was also there, and he communicated a lot with all the people there. So I think it had some influence on the cooperation. So between these players in this field. Yeah, I had then written. At that time, my only contribution was this paper with Alain Snickman on this abstract cavity method. That's a little bit a strange paper I have with the paper with Alain Snickman. In the sense that it is extremely highly cited, but actually. Not for the contribution to the directly rigorous contribution to Spinglass, but because we invented what is called now this Bolthausen-Snickmann correlation, which came out from a close investigation of the Ruel cascades. That's the reason that the paper that had a lot of influence, but not in Spinglass theory. On what we tried there in Spinglass theory was the main point in this paper was that we tried to set up to understand the mathematical structure exactly behind this cavity method, so as it appears in the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. So that was the main aim, and I think it was. This was successful. So we really set up the mathematical structure of this cavity method. So that was the main aim of this paper. So that at that time that was my only contribution to my only paper to Spinglass theory.
In your role as editor of probability theory and related fields, you did lead a number of papers on the topic appear. Were you actively encouraging these contributions, or any Fs? Can you detail how this went about?
I had close contacts with Michel Talagrand also, also. I encouraged him to publish some of his papers in PTRF. So, of course, Talagrand had his first papers that then written. Which was still everything in high temperatures. Also, these were just in the beginning high temperature result. It's probably not so much known because. The topic of these interviews is mainly about replica symmetry breakings. It's not so much known, I think, because the paper is largely forgotten to some extent. Is that the first rigorous result by Talagrand on replica symmetry breaking was an early paper he published in PTRF. He was able to do something for the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick for P-spin models which just has one level of symmetry breaking and then the paper had some shortcomings in the sense that it was not totally unconditional he couldn't really fully prove what he wanted to prove but it depended on some assumptions which were plausible, so he could remove that a little bit later but for the paper he published first in PTRF, so it contained an abstract version how to construct this pure states, and then he had a proof really that these pure states exist, And he gave the complete characterization of the distribution in terms of this cascades on this real cascades. So of course it was only one level of symmetry breaking. So he gave the Gibbs weights, etc. But he had to assume a condition. Which was relatively weak. Now the referees didn't want to have the paper, so they recommended not to take it because it was just a conditional result. But I then was reading it myself to a large extent, and I took it, despite the negative comments by the referees. I think this was really the first result on the first really of a real spin glass. So that's on symmetry breaking the real spin glass. But in that sense, I took influence. I certainly encouraged Michel to publish many of his papers in PTRF.
In the book, 10 Lectures on Random Media, which is in the early 2000s, right? 2001, yeah. I think. You wrote that most of mean field spin glass theory is still very far from mathematically rigorous understanding. At that time, were you hopeful that such an understanding would be forthcoming? And why did you think that it was important for graduate students and postdocs to hear nevertheless about this problem?
That's a difficult question. Probably among mathematicians, nobody was really hopeful that the policy formula could be proved soon. That was probably the issue. Even Talagrad told me that. That's also just an anecdote with Talagrad. Talagrad said to me, that was before he proved, of course, before Guerra and his results. So maybe 1 year before, he said to me, the only reason that I had some success in spin glass theory is that I've never tried to prove the Parisi formulas. He was just saying that he thought that this is something so fantastic, and also this is okay with all this replica symmetry breaking matrices by Parisi that he didn't have much hope that it could go into this direction. But it's always happening like that. You expect that there could not be that some problems are too difficult, and then somebody finds a way how to do it. There were actually more modest problems. I also know that Talagrand was one of the so-called modest problems is still an open mathematical open problem, namely to prove that this for Sheridan Kirkpatrick, the De Almeida-Salles line is a phase separation line. So that is still mathematically open. So you see, after the Parisi formula, it's just an analytic problem. Because one cannot characterize the AT line. Nobody has been able up to now. There are good results in this direction, but it is not fully proved that the AT line is a phase separation line. That is something I had myself then tried to prove. But I knew that Talagrand was working on that. But that's of course quite modest now compared with the development which has come. Ultrametricity was also an issue. So of course, maybe everybody's okay. At least I thought progress, for instance, in direction to understanding this replica symmetry breaking would come by mathematically understanding ultrametricity. So that was in the end the first proof by Talagrand didn't use ultrametricity. That was quite a surprise to me, actually, that it would go in this direction, that one could prove the Parisi formula before first proofing ultrametricity. So for that reason, even if probably at that time I thought that that Parisi formula would be a hopeless thing, I thought that it would be an interesting topic to go on. So.
Okay, so graduate students and postdocs should learn about this problem because of that. Can you expand a bit on why young people should have learned about this field? Did you see that as a program for the next 30 years, and therefore people should get engaged on it, or?
No, I had problems at that time. I had a PhD student, Nikola Kistler. So he has done other works on also in direction to spin glasses, but also related to spin glasses. At that time I had an idea that was before Parisi, before the Parisi formula was proved. So I had an idea at least how to go on with this AT line, with this De Almeida-Saunders line, which was based on this TAP approach, so this TAP equations, so this. And you see much later, I guess now six years ago, I published a paper on this TAP equations, which appeared in CMP and which became very influential in other directions. But at that time I had the idea that one could use this TAP approach to compute the free energy up to the AT lines and then I had proposed this problem to Nikola Kistler and we tried to work on it and then this AT thing we couldn't do that we tried for a long time. Also, Nikola was totally fascinated by spin glasses. After the first one or two years where we didn't succeed with this AT problem, I proposed him to do something else. Not related to spin glasses. So then he looked at it and he came back and said, okay, he cannot give up spin glasses. It's so interesting. So finally we did something actually in direction to ultrametricity. Which was partly successful, but they were just toy models. I think they are largely forgotten now. So this is my paper on ultrametricity because Ponchenko finally did it via the Guirlanda-Guerra identities. But we had some toy models which were related to Derrida's random energy models, but which were not ultrametric from the start for the finite end, and where in the end we could prove ultrametricity in the limit. That was just for combinatorial reasons. That was the way I was thinking at that time about it. In a sense, it was successful, but of course, after the full proof of ultrametricity, it's now maybe no longer so interesting. I don't know. So maybe it could still become one day. So.
It feels that there was a certain degree of competition in reaching a proof of the Parisi formula. Was it palpable in the community? Was there?
Yeah, very clearly.
Okay.
That was very clear. You could feel it in Ascona, actually. So there was quite some rival, some competition about that. Yeah. You could feel it. That you could feel between the main players, certainly Michael Eisenmann had different ideas from the ones of Dalagras also, and you could feel in the discussions and also everybody was talking with me, and I got it a little bit. So Talagra was commenting about Michael Eisenman. Michael Eisenman was commenting about Talagra. Guevara was commenting, etc. So it was quite. In the end, it was relaxed, but you could feel the competition, very clearly. So that was.
In your viewpoint, how important was the physics literature in reaching the proof, the mathematical physics proof?
Yeah, people couldn't do very much with this original policy thing, with these replicas this replica symmetry breaking answer. So I think this is, I know that some people are still very much interested to make it to turn it into something rigorous. So for instance, Girard Benarous had some ideas about it. So but I think it never substantiated. So this thing with this replica symmetry breaking matrices, that didn't play a big role, I think, in mathematics up to now. So people were just okay. They looked at it as a kind of miracle I was giving a short course in Vancouver about spin classes, and then I spent 2 hours explaining this Parsi's derivation of the Parsi formula. So afterwards, somebody told me that this is the most non-rigorous thing he had ever heard about. The cavity approach was of course very very. But that was also extremely important for whatever I had been doing on it, and also Talagrand. You see, Talagrand's first papers on high temperature. You see, he didn't. Okay, he had a huge amount of work on different models. So where he applied. So he had papers on the perceptron, he had papers on the KSAT problem, he had papers on the it's all contained in his book also. So and essentially, okay, many of the things are still used. So for instance, for the perceptron, there's still no math. Okay, very few. I just know one recent result about low temperature results in the perceptron case. There are a few, but it's very far from getting a complete picture for this perceptron. So, and then Talagrand had an enormously complicated derivation of the replica symmetry formula for the perceptron. So it takes 3 chapters or more or less in his books and so on. But that's all based on the cavity method, on these versions of the cavity method. I just very recently have a paper on the perceptron with together with Naoki Sun and John Chisu and Shuta Nakajima, so where we have a different proof, so, and they're slightly more general, so, which is based on the TAP approach. You certainly also, you see, that's of course very recent that people got more interested in this TAP business, so this TAP thing. And there's the original paper by Thouless, Anderson, Palmer is just nowadays playing an enormous role in the mathematical development. So there are very interesting developments on this TAP approach by a number of people. So in mathematics. Ili Ranzubach has papers, recent papers on this TAP business, which are very interesting and give a lot of insights.
So you mentioned that course in Vancouver that you gave, but you know, at the University of Zurich or elsewhere, did you ever teach other classes about spin glasses or replica symmetry breaking? And if yes, can you detail the context and the content?
Yeah, I was giving not in Zurich. So actually, we had when Panchenko's book was out, so we made a seminar on that, actually, which was quite influential. So in the sense that I know for instance, David Belius told me that this seminar we had in Zurich influenced him to go to spin glass theory. So he's presently at the University of Basel. He's a young. Mm-hmm. A young researcher, and I never was teaching in Zurich on spin glass theory. I gave a course in Kyoto once, I know at least of one young Japanese researcher who became influenced by this course I gave there. So that's Shuta Nakajima. So he's also he just got a permanent position in Japan. So
was this recently or in the early 2000s or roughly?
No, it was more recently. It was I have all this difficulty to remember the dates. So it was around 2015. I was giving a course. I could also present my results on the tap business and also, okay, it was then also giving the results by Panchenko, how Panchenko proved ultrametricity how it can be used to prove the Parisi formula in this way.
In the long run, right, over your career, some people have told us that the prestige of probability has increased over the math in the math community. Is that your impression as well? And how did spin glass play any role in that perception of the subfield?
It's certainly the case. So that is clear. You see that there had been now Fields Medal Fields medals in going to probability most of the topics I don't know if I can say that, but I think most of the topics say that the mathematicians were most impressed by are somehow related to mathematical physics. So you see this Fields Medal went to people working on these two-dimensional models, which are related to this conformal field theory. And then this is Schramm-Löwner evolution equations and things like that, which are related to this conformal field theory and spin glass theory. I think too. So maybe to a less extent. Maybe if somebody below 40 would have proved the Parisi formula, you would have gotten the Fields Medal. That could well be. But now. This was by Guerra and Talagrand. It's actually even growing. To some extent. Now people in applied probability and statistics became very much. You're probably aware of that now. People in applied statistics became very much interested in spin glass theory. Do you know about that? So for instance, what Montanari, particularly the Stanford school, so Montanari and his people. It's partly influenced by, probably my best paper on spin glasses is this recent one. It's not so recent one, it's a couple of years ago on this TAP equation. Are you aware of that? This thing. So where I where I construct an algorithm. It's just high temperature, but it works up to the AT line for Sherrington Kirkpatrick. So originally I thought, okay, it's just okay. I published it, but essentially it was a failure because I wanted to prove the free energy up to the AT line long, long time ago. So, but finally I published this paper just on these tap iterations, which converge up to the AT line. Now, fortunately, I hadn't read anything about in the literature, so it was actually very good that I hadn't read anything because it was well known among people like Parisi that this tap equations behave very unstably even in high temperatures. So then I found the right way to look at it. I published it in CMP. I thought, okay, send it to CMP. Probably they are not taking it. So I was not aware that I had solved a long-standing open problem. So that was somehow came as a surprise to me. So, but then even more surprising was actually that it had a lot of influence on this development of algorithms in this compressed sensing business. So that's now okay. I don't mention it because it is my paper, but just to mention how influential actually ideas from spin class theory have become just in totally different fields. For instance, in theoretical computer science, I know Koya Oglan a little bit, and he, I knew that he started to become interested in spin classes just from theoretical computer. He was originally not coming from mathematical physics. I remember he was giving a talk, and then he didn't yet work on it. But he was totally fascinated by predictions of coming from spin class series. So now in the meantime, he's working very, very, and I think he has very good results also, just influenced by spin class theory and this whole Parisi approach of replica symmetry breaking.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or overlooked?
Nothing really important, I guess. I had made some notes, okay, on this, but no, I think
okay.
I think that was
So in closing, do you have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you intend to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Probably I don't have much. For some time I was exchanging things with Michel Talagrand, probably I don't have anything which could be of interest. So these were just email exchanges I don't really think.
If ever you do find emails.
I was just thinking with Telegram, we had a number of exchanges. So he was mainly asking me about literature at the beginning, and then we had a bit of exchange what was going on. But we didn't have really very close contact about scientifically very close contact. No, I don't think that I have anything. No.
Fair enough. Professor Balthausen, thank you very much for your time and for this conversation. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. So it was a pleasure to talk about this development. So, you're welcome.